this will get him, I think, exactly what he needs, is people saying, now I'm going to pay attention and I'd like to know more about him.
U.S. Senate candidate Dan Sullivan makes a statement with fundraising numbers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 14th. Good evening, I'm Maury Townsend. Also tonight, Juneau businesses wade into the murky waters of the cyber currency Bitcoin.
There's a lot of talk about Bitcoin. I mean, I've been talking about Bitcoin pretty much nonstop for the last month and a half, you know, since it shot through the roof.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by the 2014 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
The U.S. Senate campaign of Dan Sullivan announced today how much money he collected in his first 3 months of fundraising, $1.2 million. It's a fast start for the former Natural Resources Commissioner, who is in a three-way race for the Republican primary. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
None of the other candidates has released a fourth quarter total yet, but judging by previous reports, Sullivan is likely to have raised a lot more than his Republican rivals, Mead Treadwell and Joe Miller. Even incumbent Senator Mark Begich hasn't raised $1.2 million in a single quarter so far, although he raised more than twice that in the first 9 months of last year. Sullivan campaign spokesman Mike Anderson says it'll take serious money to go against Begich.
You know, we're honored and thankful for the support that we've received from Alaskans and people across the country.
The campaign isn't saying how much of that money is from Alaskans. Sullivan has held multiple Lower 48 fundraisers. His spokesman says the details will be in the report they file with the Federal Election Commission, and that isn't due until the end of the month. Anchorage political consultant Art Hackney, who is raising money for a pro-Sullivan PAC, says posting an impressive number puts Sullivan on the map.
I think the biggest thing that people have been saying is they're not quite sure who he is. This will get him, I think, exactly what he needs, is people saying, well, now I'm going to pay attention. I'd like to know more about him.
A survey by Ivan Moore published last month shows Treadwell leading with 34% of the vote in a three-way Republican primary. But Sullivan was close behind, nearly within the margin of error. The survey showed Joe Miller winning in much of the rail belt, including Fairbanks, Matsu, and the Kenai Peninsula, and Treadwell ahead in Anchorage and Southeast. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A delegation from Shishmaref is visiting Congress to explain how their world is changing. Shishmaref Native Corporation President Tony Weiwana told lawmakers at a climate task force meeting the village used to have so much beach they played baseball on it. Now, with the water level rising and the island eroding, they don't have enough shore to dig clams. 17-year-old Deborah Hirsrud says Shishmaref is changing faster than she can grow up.
I remember one afternoon my mom came to get me from my grandparents' house. As a result from the storm, the back of our house and the back of our stairs were dangling over the cliff in the ocean. It was scary. We had to immediately move all our things out of the house, and we went to go stay with my grandparents. And later that year, we moved away.
The family was gone for 8 years. When they came back, Deborah found a smaller island with favorite places for egg collecting and duck hunting had eroded away.
It really does scare me. One day, Shishmaref just won't be there. This is where I grew up, and this is where my grandparents grew up, and where my grandparents' parents grew up. And one day, I hope to come back to Shishmaref after college, but I don't know if it'll be there.
Eileen Cole, a spokeswoman for Act on Climate Change, says the coalition sponsored the trip to show Washington the tangible harm climate change is already bringing to Americans. The group is scheduled to meet with White House, EPA, and Interior officials. Only a handful of House members attended the meeting on Capitol Hill today, and all of them are already sympathetic to the cause. A federal lawsuit filed by a Cook Inlet fishermen's group seeks to overturn state salmon management in some parts of Alaska. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the suit targets the National Marine Fisheries Service, among other federal agencies, and if successful, could bring federal oversight into some of the state's salmon harvests.
The 300 drift netters that belong to United Cook Inlet Drift Association, or UCDA, say the state's current Cook Inlet Salmon Management Plan violates the Magnuson-Stevens Act, and they're suing. The suit was filed by UCDA a year ago in federal district court in Washington, D.C. It challenges the validity of Amendment 12 of the Fisheries Management Plan, or FMP, for salmon fisheries in the Federal Exclusive Economic Zone, or EEZ, off the coast of Alaska. Amendment 12 essentially eliminates the EEZ waters in three areas of Alaska: parts of Prince William Sound, Cook Inlet, and the western end of the Alaska Peninsula. Dr. Roland Ma heads Soldotna-based UCDA.
Half the area where we fish is in the federal EEZ. These are in federal waters, and they are federally owned fish at that point. And as such, we felt the federal government has a piece of legislation called Magnuson-Stevens Act that has certain requirements concerning the biology and the management of those stocks.
The state of Alaska has intervened in the suit on the side of the defendants because Amendment 12 removes federal oversight from the three areas and allows the state to manage salmon in those areas as it has since statehood. Cora Campbell is commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and testified Tuesday at a finance subcommittee hearing on the issue in Anchorage.
If you talk to federal managers, they will tell you why they are so ill-suited to manage salmon fisheries. Salmon fisheries management requires responsive in-season management. We respond to what we're seeing on the ground on at least a daily, if not an hourly, basis.
Campbell has a voting seat on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. She says Amendment 12 was crafted in 2011 specifically to keep state management of salmon in the three areas. The UCDA suit defies the very intention of statehood, according to Chugiak Representative Bill Stoltz, who chaired Tuesday's hearing.
They wanted the obscurity of a D.C. courtroom, and now they've lost that. Now it's in an Alaskan venue, and with the state aggressively asserting the rights of state management.
But Ma points out that Southeast Alaska has a fisheries management plan for salmon, something that applies to fish stocks that require conservation. And UCDA is not asking for anything different.
Both of these governments need to be at the table deciding what will be the management strategy. We've got, I think, five or six Chinook stocks in Cook Inlet that are in trouble. We have stocks that are now, if people would make the applications, could qualify for endangered species.
Ma says that UCDA only wants the state and federal governments to manage the stocks as they move into Alaska waters because what goes on in the EEZ affects what goes on in state waters. An assistant attorney general for the state says the arguments could be heard in a month and a decision could come by early summer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, restoring Alaska's oldest Haida Longhouse.
It's a matter of our cultural revitalization and showing that we're still here and part of these lands.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Public Education Health Trust, formerly NEA Alaska Health Plan, delivers cost-effective health plans for Alaska families. They help Alaska's educational professionals, from school bus drivers to teachers, manage their health plan benefits efficiently. Public Education Health Trust provides members with low-cost plans, more choices, and local control, advocating for 17,000 Alaskans and their health care needs. This message sponsored by Public Education Health Trust.
Bitcoin is a digital currency not backed by any country's government. The currency only exists on the internet and has been growing in popularity over the past year and a half. Now, a few businesses in the capital city are starting to deal in Bitcoin and accept it for payment. KTOO's Lisa Fu reports.
Do you have any comic books about Minecraft?
Oh, that's a good question, about Minecraft.
In the Alaska Robotics Shop in downtown Juneau, shelves are lined with comic books and graphic novels, local art hangs from the walls, and kids talk about Minecraft.
It's kind of sciencey too, though. You put sand in a furnace and you make glass.
Another hot topic at the shop, Bitcoin. Owner Pat Race got his first Bitcoin last spring.
I sent like a MoneyGram off to some Eastern European country, and then my Bitcoin appeared in an account.
Race bought $150 worth, which at the time equaled one Bitcoin. Since then, the value of Bitcoin has fluctuated.
Back at the beginning of 2013, the price was about $18, $19 for a Bitcoin, and it peaked at about $1,242 in mid-November, and then immediately crashed down to almost $500 in December, and is back up to about $800, $850.
Race wants to incorporate Bitcoin into his business.
I would like to adopt Bitcoin here at the store just because I think that it's something that will emerge as a global currency. And I don't know if specifically it will be Bitcoin, but I think some kind of cryptocurrency is in our future.
Alaska Robotics recently advertised its first item selling for Bitcoin, a limited edition print of Miley Cyrus riding a Bitcoin with drones flying overhead. It costs 0.04 Bitcoin. That's the equivalent of roughly $30. And Race is only accepting Bitcoin. He's not the only business owner in Juneau embracing cryptocurrency. In the window of gold and silver exchange at Nugget Mall, a sign reads, Bitcoin, buy, sell.
It's only been there about 3 weeks, but it's got a lot of attention.
Owner Dylan Hammonds has only sold Bitcoin to one person, but he's not worried. He considers his shop the hub of the Bitcoin community.
There's a lot of talk about Bitcoin. I mean, I've been talking about Bitcoin pretty much nonstop for the last month and a half, you know, since it shot through the roof. So I'm chatting everybody up about it, you know, and there's a lot of people that are showing interest and people are aware of it now.
Hammond says some people who got into Bitcoin a couple years ago are now Bitcoin millionaires.
From what I hear, there's actually a Bitcoin millionaire walking around town here. So that's pretty big news.
Is that person you?
Mm-mm. No, it's not me. I wish it was.
Hammond hopes to capitalize on educating others about Bitcoin, specifically other Juneau businesses.
The more people get Bitcoin in their hand, the more they're going to want to spend it. So as time goes on, more people are going to be coming into their shops and asking, hey, do you guys take Bitcoin? And then the businesses are going to be like, oh, hey, wait a minute, we better figure this thing out. So then they're going to be calling people. And that's where I come in and I go and show them how to do it.
Northern Economics senior economist Jonathan King is surprised with the Bitcoin activity in Juneau businesses.
Wow, they're starting to accept Bitcoin, huh?
He doesn't know of other Alaska businesses doing it, but thinks those that are may be ahead of the curve.
It's really interesting and definitely puts those businesses out on the leading edge of a new frontier.
With that, King says, comes inherent risk.
If you end up in a volatile currency that, you know, changes value rapidly, you could end up a big winner or you could end up a big loser.
Alaska Robotics owner Pat Race admits the concept of accepting Bitcoin is a bit gimmicky at this point.
But it's also like a technology that I want to support. I think that tourists that come in and say like, oh, wow, I found the shop in Alaska that took Bitcoin. Like, I think it would be a very limited number, but those people will be excited to see it.
This summer, Race plans to accept Bitcoin for everything in the store, which means soon you can go into Alaska Robotics and buy a Minecraft comic book with the symbol of your smartphone. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
A local militia leader is organizing an anti-gun control rally that'll be held next month in downtown Fairbanks. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the rally is one of five to be held around the state on February 23rd to show support for the Second Amendment and other right-wing political causes.
There's not a lot of controversy over gun control here in Alaska. Most Alaskans own guns, and most politicians know the importance of holding a lifetime NRA membership. But gun control remains a hot topic in the lower 48. In response to gun-related crime and mass shootings, legislatures in several states have passed or are considering several gun control laws. That's why David Luntz and other gun control advocates around Alaska believe it's important to reiterate their anti-gun control message.
a lot of legislative movement to limit our Second Amendment rights, and that's really the purpose behind the rally.
Luntz says the 2014 Day of Resistance rallies will be held February 23rd at Veterans Park and in Anchorage, Juneau, Wasilla, and the Kenai. They're modeled after the events held on the same date last year nationwide to protest gun control proposals in Congress and executive actions by President Obama. Luntz holds the rank of interim commander of the Central Alaska Militia, one of several such organizations in Alaska. He says the rallies are not militia events, but given the issues that'll be talked about, he wouldn't be surprised if some members show up.
You know, it is about the Second Amendment, so I would imagine that there would be a number of groups, not only possibly the militia, but maybe the Second Amendment Task Force or some other groups out there throughout the state that will participate in their local rallies.
That's okay, says Mike Bork, the Fairbanks North Star Borough Parks and Recreation Director, as long as nobody violates the laws by discharging weapons or trying to sell one.
As long as they're obeying the law and have followed the proper procedures to rent the space, we welcome them, as we would with any group.
Luntz says he and other organizers intend to keep the rally peaceful to counter the negative image of the movement created by, among other things, former militia leader Schaefer Cox, who's now serving a 26-year federal prison sentence for plotting to kill judges and law enforcement officers. Luntz says he wants the rally to serve as an example of an orderly, peaceful exercise of First Amendment rights in defense of the Second Amendment. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Next month, the World Wildlife Fund is releasing a report on walrus ivory. KNOM Zechariah Hughes reports.
Ernie Cooper is the director for the Traffic and Wildlife Trade Program at WWF Canada and is in charge of the pending report.
We've been conducting a study of international trade and management of walruses, looking at the global trade.
The study comes in the context of WWF's work with different governmental organizations and conservation groups combating illegal ivory trafficking across the globe, which for the most part means elephant ivory. But WWF decided to look at the market for walrus ivory in part because they expected there might be some overlap in the trade patterns. Cooper says what they found is that basically there's no reliable way of establishing numbers for what's going on with walrus.
One of the results is that it's very hard to get a really precise handle on international walrus trade for a couple of reasons, partially because the majority of walrus ivory trade is in carvings, and it's not possible to quantify, you know, how many carvings equal one walrus. So the most basic question, how many walruses are in international trade, can't actually be answered in any real manner.
On top of the limitations of aggregating walrus numbers through carvings, there are just four countries in the world with walrus harvests: the U.S., Russia, Canada, and Greenland. And if anyone is keeping records on that information, it's not getting shared. Cooper says that even amid barriers to their research, the preliminary findings simply didn't uncover anything illicit going on.
We weren't able to find much evidence of illegal trade in walrus.
He is quick to caution, however, that there's a possibility researchers just haven't found a practical way of assessing the peculiar markets for walrus ivory.
The challenge there is that absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence.
What Cooper couldn't address was how ongoing efforts at eliminating market demand for ivory products might affect hunters and carvers in Alaska. Senator Mark Begich's recent letter to Interior Department Secretary Sally Jewell asked the agency to exercise restraint in upcoming policy recommendations on measures to combat illegal ivory trafficking. Begich's concern is that a broad sweeping condemnation of ivory products will negatively affect subsistence communities who rely on walrus ivory for income. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Zechariah Hughes.
A nearly half-million-dollar grant will speed speed up restoration of Alaska's oldest Haida longhouse. The structure was first built 130 years ago, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Haida Chief Sonahat built the original longhouse in the 1880s at the village of Kasan. It's on the eastern side of Southeast's Prince of Wales Island, about 30 miles northwest of Ketchikan. It was called Negiwan's the Great House. Many know it as the Whale House after some of the carvings inside. It deteriorated as wooden buildings in the rainforest do. The Civilian Conservation Corps rebuilt it in the late 1930s. Now, the house badly needs repair again.
It's a matter of our cultural revitalization and showing that we're still here and part of these lands.
Richard Peterson is president of the Tribal Council for the Organized Village of Kasan. The tribal government is partnering with the Native Village Corporation, Kavilco, and its cultural arm, the Kasan Haida Heritage Foundation.
A lot of the building is in still really good condition. Really, just some of the support areas is what's failing. I think we're fortunate enough with our situation that we don't need a total reconstruction. So we want to kind of maintain as much as we can.
An analysis by Juneau-based MRV Architects estimated full repairs would cost more than $2 million. A scaled-back plan totaled about $1.4 million. It listed several phases to be completed as funds came in. And they have. In late November, the Anchorage-based Rasmussen Foundation awarded the project $450,000. Peterson says that, plus funds from the tribal government and its partners, is about enough to complete the work.
So right now we're milling up the logs, and they're going to hand adds all the timbers, and we're just going in and starting to secure up some of the corners that are dropping down. It's been a really exciting project.
The effort to stabilize the longhouse has been underway for about 2 years, but it picked up speed last summer. The lead carver is Stormy Hamer, who is working with apprentices Eric Hamer, his son, and Harley Bell Holder. Others volunteer. Peterson says it's an all-ages effort.
The great part is these young kids that are getting involved, and it's across the lines, native, non-native, doesn't matter. There's been a real interest by the youth there.
Work continues through the winter. Peterson says the focus now is repairing or replacing structural elements so the longhouse doesn't collapse. Without too many surprises, Peterson hopes work can be completed in around 2 years. This is Ed Schoenfeld.
Sunday marked the final day of the Dena'ina Athabaskan exhibit at the Anchorage Museum. A culmination of 7 years of work, the exhibit reveals the art, history, culture, and science of the people whose territory Anchorage now encompasses. Aaron Leggett is one of the curators and a Dena'ina tribal member. We walked through the exhibit one last time on Sunday. Leggett says thousands of Anchorage school children, residents, and tourists visited during the four-month run. The exhibit starts with a contemporary fish camp scene. One of Leggett's favorite parts of the exhibit is a slideshow of the Dena'ina people.
What's been really powerful about this is I think there's 180 images and it takes about 12 minutes to watch. But I know Dena'ina people that have sat here and watched the entire slideshow, and they see pictures of their family. They've seen pictures of themselves or their parents, grandparents, great-grandparents. And that's the thing. It's not just about pretty objects in the past. It's about people, and it's about our people. So to have images that go back to the 1880s all the way up to literally last summer, some of these photographs were taken. Again, it shows that continuity over time. So despite all the changes that have occurred, the offices, the shopping malls, the movie theaters, this is still our homeland, and we're still here as a people.
When you were doing the research and collecting items, you're quite young yourself. Was it odd to think about, I imagine it gave you a better visual of what this area looked like that's now so urbanized. What were your thoughts about that?
Yeah, when I got into college and I started to learn more, it really informed the place that I lived in. It opened my eyes to think that, when my grandmother was a child, for example, that, we had fish camps here in Anchorage and that they would go to them and were able to put up thousands of fish. And in some ways, we'll be, you know, the lasting legacy of the exhibit. I mean, for example, we're standing in front of the display case with the traditional clothing that would have been worn during the 19th century, the tanned caribou hide and woven porcupine quill embroidery. It's really spectacular and really fine work, and is a style of clothing that hasn't been done during the 20th century. So we actually don't even know a lot of how it was done, because the Dena'ina gave up this style by about the 1880s. So it's really kind of eye-opening even to our own people to see these things, because we've heard stories about them, but we've never actually seen them up close and personal.
One of the displays in this exhibit is the tabletop, which I found incredibly cool.
Yeah.
Describe that for people that haven't been here.
It's called the Dena'ina Dining Table. And what we did is we had a special camera mount set up high above up in the ceiling, and it filmed down on a table. And then we had eight individuals, our advisors and myself included, who sat around the table with traditional Dena'ina foods, and we had a Dena'ina meal. Everybody sat around and we talked about the foods, we talked about being on the land. It's in English and it's in Dena'ina, some of it, and we just had a good time. After we filmed it, we had a projector set up, and it actually throws the image down onto the almost a full-size table, so it's almost a one-to-one image. Of all the things actually in the exhibition, that's been visitor feedback. That's the number one object that we've done.
What are you hoping that the residents of Anchorage and people who have come here to see this exhibit, what are you hoping they go away with? What was the whole idea of what you were trying to achieve here?
I think probably number one, anybody who now, when they say Dena'ina, they can put an image to it. When I was a kid and I said Dena'ina, people would say, well, what's that? I'd say, well, we're the people of this area. And then people would say, well, I didn't know natives used to live here. And I said, well, we still live here. So, you know, I mean, I don't know. Every time they see the Dena'ina Center, they'll now have an image of who the people are. That's my hope.
Aaron Leggett is a co-curator of the Dena'ina Athabascan exhibit. He will receive the Governor's Award for Arts in the Humanities later this month in Juneau. A smaller version of the exhibit will travel to Homer, Kenai, and Fairbanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Lisa Fu and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Zachariah Hughes in Nome. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. Electronic health records give doctors, nurses, and families secure access to medical information when and where it's needed most. If it's providing a new doctor access to your child's medical history or taking a loved one to the emergency room, electronic health records provide safe, secure, life-saving information on the spot. For more information, go to ak-ehealth.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services in partnership with the Alaska eHealth Network.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.